there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb. Today, I'm joined by Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Scott Keith, Adam Francisco, and Dan Van Voris. We are on episode 4 of Christianity in America, which Dan has been kindly leading us through with some excellent preparation and outlines, which is making it pretty great for people like me. I am not an expert in this area at all. And so it's been really awesome to have Dan on to be able to do this. Today's episode is going to focus on the Second Great Awakening and some of the, I think we said at the end of the last episode, some of the craziness that comes out of there.
It's a particular time in American history, and there's lots of, I think, decadence and excess, which is kind of the, you know, a model of
SUVs and Big Macs.
Yeah, we go boom and bust in America. We go big and small, and this is a time of big. And it's, you know, if you think about last time we were looking at 1730s to 1790s, now you can basically think pre-Civil War, think 19th century, so 1800s, right? Mm. So not only are you going to have the Second Great Awakening, but you're also going to have things like the move westward. You're going to have the Industrial Revolution, right? Things that are really, by 1848, we're going to go coast to coast. So not only do we have theological things happening, but oftentimes these theological things are happening in response to what's happening culturally. So depending on where you're sort of in mind, you know, if you're more historian-minded or more theologically minded, that might help.
Cool. Is there there's so much progress happening right now in America at this time, technological progress, expansion west. I'm assuming population, pretty massive population growth.
Huge,
too.
Yeah.
Does that translate to sort of a idea of wanting to be progressive also in other things, i.e. like their politics and the way they worship and their religion and their beliefs and that type of thing?
Yeah, I think, you know, progressive is a good word for it because it's saying what's next, right?
Yeah.
It's saying, yeah, that, you know, at best, that plus. At worst, forget that. Let's go forward, right? And I think that is that's a very American impulse. And sometimes that's great when it's innovation and when it's, you know, in the sciences or we've certainly seen this.
Medicine,
sure. But theologically, we question innovation.
It makes sense. I mean, when everything is sort of changing around you and big change. Caleb and I had this discussion not too long ago because we were arguing sort of what was the biggest change. And he was talking about the internet and I was talking about the Industrial Revolution because we were mountain biking, I think, and we were up on top of a hill sort of overlooking one of the valleys. Maybe it's like...
Oh, is it down here?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was just inward San Clemente, maybe Rancho.
Yeah, and it's just amazing because none of that was there, right? And I think I made the comment that we actually haven't come, from the time you're talking about, we haven't come that far from then to now with, like, we have cars, we have the houses, we have indoor plumbing, we have, you know, what's changed is personalized technology. And even that change, which I don't think is as great as the change that's going on here, where you're going from only horse and carriage, if you're lucky, to being able to travel large distances on a train.
Yeah.
You know, individually, right? You don't necessarily have to get a whole group of people to come along so that you're protected and whatnot. This has got to be a total just turnaround in the way the sort of everyday person thinks about the possibilities of life.
Absolutely. When we talk about the change from Industrial Revolution to the present, we're talking about a change in degree. We're talking about things faster. But before, we're talking about a world where there is no concept of speed or outside of what an animal can run.
Or things had pretty much been the same for 10,000 years.
Yeah.
And then within, 300-ish years, you know, everything changes.
Yeah. And so there's that change, and historians have made the point that change from pre-speed to post-speed just changes everything. Right.
Yeah, what took a lifetime takes a week.
And the idea that, you know, today not only can we be so individual, but then also we can travel everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Your life took place between mountains. You know, you were between mountains.
Because you didn't want to go over them.
Exactly. Geography played all the difference in the world. And as we talked about on the last show, community was essential. Now, as we move into the Industrial Revolution, what we're going to see is the more and more of the sort of individualization of American everything. But I think most important for us, theology. And just as there were, you know, great men of industry, there were a number of people who saw these men of industry and said, I bet, what if we took some of those business models, those development engineering models, and we moved them over to the church, right? This sounds hopefully very parallel to many of you. Mm-hmm. And the king of this is really the king of the Second Great Awakening, and that's a guy named Charles Finney. And Charles Finney, with his new measures,
is really a heretic.
He is really saying, "Hey, we're going to use the business model that this Industrial Revolution. We're going to apply those methods to the church and wait to see what happens."
Well, you never see that today.
Yeah, no.
Good thing that went out of style. Yeah.
We got to talk to the business pastor.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, really. I mean, it's sort of a crass version. When I used to teach, I'd ask kids, you know, before we would talk about this, you know, think of the worst sequel of a movie, right? Think of a sequel that just ruined the first one almost because it was so bad. That's the Second Great Awakening. It's just the worst sequel.
That's very good.
It's the worst sequel in American history. World War II is like our Godfather II, you know, like a little better than the first. But in terms of this one, yeah, I'm going to go with that.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Star Wars comes to mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, Star Wars does come to mind.
Well, the case of Finney, Adam, he denied every major doctrine of Christianity.
Well, about 20 years ago, you had me, well, I think I chose to outline some of Charles Finney's sermons for your outlining project. Uh-huh. And I was amazed. I was like, wow. Because he's a hero in American Christianity.
I walked in Billy Graham Center and there's a thing in oil.
Yeah. I mean, he outright rejects justification by faith.
Oh, yeah.
And grace through faith. With like a slimy car dealer smile.
Yeah.
Because that's how you, and there were ways in which that's how you proved yourself. You proved yourself by saying, oh, what do those guys dig? What do they believe? What do they hold is the only thing? Oh, I don't believe that. And so that's why you see these radical statements like, oh, justification? I'll leave it. Yeah. Now, we're going to see this in a more sophisticated way move its way in through theological liberalism later.
Yep.
But it's important to see that as people are throwing off the yoke of tyranny and supposed tyranny, in a way, they can go goofy. And Finney is a great example of that. Yep. The theology is gone, right? He denies it all.
Is that a reaction to anything else going on there? Is that a reaction to like the opposite? Like
the Northeast. The scholasticism of the Northeast. There's already a legend of this kind of Puritanism which never existed, which is going to kind of cloud a certain picture of the Northeast.
Okay.
Right? It really is more of an English thing, and it didn't. We all have these pictures of these certain paths, but that's going to be those stuffy Puritans up there, mm-hmm. down here in Kentucky, down here in the South, we do what we like. And I mean, you see this throughout American history, right? You see the same thing today.
So the regionalism and sort of the division of the United States is then getting even worse, is what I'm hearing, probably.
Yeah, but I mean, there are a number of things here. The Louisiana Purchase, obviously, in the beginning of the century. But as you move away from the 13 colonies, the federalism, states' rights, that kind of language, which is so present in the founding documents, the language of states as federations disappears.
Yeah.
It's not something we do anymore, and so it becomes regional. Mm. And as we mentioned on the last show, the North-South is as theological as it is social, right? It's as much about their view of the Westminster Confession of Faith and how strictly you had to hold to it, as much as it did slavery in some places. Hmm. So it's just a really, really interesting division that's starting to take place. The North, the South, you have, and then the frontier.
Yeah, is there a race between these two to win the West?
Oh, I don't, yeah, that's a good question. I don't think there's a race in the Northeast. Why would you leave? But if you're, you know, so they would say. I've been there and left many times happily. But in the South, I mean, it really is. I mean, this is going to kick up with obviously Lincoln and the plan to kind of populate the West. But you know, the further you get from the places of power, the more you can be naughty. Isn't it, you know, St. Louis is always worried about that Irvine school, right? Way over there on the coast. Oh. The farther you get away from the power, the pillars of power, you know, they assume, sometimes rightly so, that you're being naughty.
They think that Orthodox confessional Lutheranism can't make it over the Rockies.
I've heard people say that if you're a Lutheran in California, you're probably liberal, which is kind of outstanding to me. But
well, this is the problem. The problem is that that's fine to make regional distinctions in the 19th century.
Yeah, really?
However, we move so
welcome
much.
To the internet.
Yeah, welcome to the age of click, click, click.
Robert Preuss was out visiting. He oversaw my colloquy into LCMS, and he asked me what I used in doctrine. I said Mueller or Kaler. He said, in California?
The left coast, well, which is, you know, Scott, as you said earlier, this idea of progressives, and we think of progressive ideology, these are the people who sometimes have, I mean, you're heading to the West, usually because life in the East ain't so good.
Right.
So anything new, gonna
or at
be
least
better than
you don't have as many opportunities there,
perhaps,
as you might here, because they're all taken up. And
if you're landed, man, you're gonna stay where you are.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah,
but you don't have that, and so it does form this ethos. So I get the ethos of us being the Wild West. I get that ethos. It just doesn't work after, you know, plains.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and yeah, there is a modern idea that California. Current California is somewhat liberal. Well, I don't know where
people get
it. I don't
know
where
they get that. Yeah,
but at the same time, I mean, to say something, that's just uninformed, really, of some of the like individual pockets here in even Southern California. Like Orange County Christianity, like South Orange County Christianity, is historically very conservative.
We are getting there. I think it's the fifth or the sixth time, and it's one of my favorite things because the whole epicenter of the church moves to about 2 miles that way.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's right here in Orange County. And like we see in this era, it's theological and political. Those things are always tied together in a way that I think sometimes we overlook.
We also tend to, in Lutheranism, in American Lutheranism, I think, especially in our synod and in the LCMS, sort of have a misconception of what makes liberal. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it'd be like, oh my gosh, you allowed a guitar in your service? Boy, you must be liberal as heck. And for any of us, or all of us, who've studied elsewhere, like in other countries, like in Europe, someone is liberal, really, theologically, if they're denying, you know, some pretty main tenets of Christianity, mostly having to do, like what you said in the last episode, with, do you think miracles are possible? Do you think, you know, divine intervention is possible? Do you think, or do you think it's just not? Are you like a strict materialist, or do you think that these things are actually possible? Man, you want to meet a liberal, go take a class from somebody who's a quote-unquote Christian theologian who doesn't believe in the resurrection.
Yeah.
And they
that's
can't,
liberal.
And they can't, exactly, because the supernatural is a priori
gone.
Gone.
Yeah.
And
so it has to be something else.
Yeah, yeah.
So last episode we talked about sort of an American Christianity sort of really developed that's going outward. We have the first American mission.
Yeah, I mean, as America is kind of, you know, gone from sea to shining sea, where next? And the where next first is Cuba, right? And there are other places, right? And that's the beginning of sort of America.
American imperialism.
Imperialism, yeah, in a way that was just not thought of beforehand.
Thanks, Teddy.
And there's a way in which the theological world fits that same sort of imperialist, to use that language, to use that same idea. Mm. And so you have the mixed bag of American foreign missions, which has been at times a force for great good, but oftentimes just kind of, you know, exporting American religion. And often the stuff that we're kind of inventing, the newer stuff, is the stuff we've sent out. It's worth noting that it's in this time period, speaking of us sending things out to the rest of the world, you have Mormons, you have the Millerites and the Adventists, you have Mary Baker Eddy. I mean, these are all, right, they begin as the Bible plus, and then they, you know, go where these movements tend to go. But that becomes something that we export to the rest of the world, right? Mm. And That's part of this foreign missions movement. Now, I don't want to speak ill of it completely. There are men like Hudson Taylor and Brainerd and Livingston who are going out with that kind of old-time, yep. supernatural, here's the Bible, we'll give it to you in your language.
Yep.
Right? Protestant missionaries, when they're at their best.
Yeah, translation.
They're giving
there are
you the
some
Bible
real heroes
language.
In this.
Absolutely.
I mean,
yeah.
In my sort of world, Samuel Zwemer, the apostle to Islam.
Yep.
I mean, a guy who yep. sacrifices everything to learn the language the way that is spoken in the Middle East. And
yep.
You know, he's not trying to export some American. Of course, he's going to bring with him some of these Americans.
But in his mind, that's best. Not what he's trying
it's
to do.
It's not primarily so, that in yeah, a way
right.
that.
It's a mix. I think you said it's a mixed bag.
Yeah.
It's all over the map.
Like you said, all these movements have theological and political implications. Mm-hmm. So you have those people with a very specific political background going somewhere with none of that context and sort of imposing it all.
It's a weird world, and there are historians who trace this as part of the build up to World War I of mm-hmm. America getting involved in the rest of the world. You're not involved. And then you have some missionaries over there, and then something happens, and the foreign diplomat is talking to your president, and now even though we said we don't go outside of our own borders...
We have Americans over there.
We have Americans in another country, and we're we're involved. And so that, along with some other things, I think the nationalism, hyper-nationalism of Wagner and others, as that's coming to be, and then the reductionism of Marx and Darwin... It's all kind of tied together in an interesting way, and I think our best job is to kind of look at it and say, to look at it and say, what do we keep and what do we ditch?
Cool. So, I have next on the list here African American spirituality, which, like you said, we're in pre-Civil War here. So,
yeah.
So what's the influence that?
Let's go Lex Orendi, Lex Credendi again.
Who's right? ruling over them?
It's the order, it's the way you pray, the way you worship is the way you believe.
Hmm.
And in a place without any hierarchy, I mean, there's no pastors or priests, really, if you're a slave. You are in a communitarian, sort of egalitarian community. And what have you brought with you from the homeland? Songs, rhythms. You know, ways of sort of call and response, speaking to one another. And all of these things are going to, as everything else will, kind of, you know, become part of their faith, part of their Christianity and their expression of Christianity. And so African-American Christianity, which has had a very wide impact in America through the African Methodist Episcopal Church, the AME Church, that all kind of comes out of this very particular slave African-American religion that even after the Civil War and after the slaves were emancipated still became part of their past.
Are they given sort of Christianity from owners? I guess that's a cruel way to say that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the ways in which a number of people justified slavery was by not treating them as slaves in the sense that they beat them and didn't feed them and didn't teach them, right? You would, you know... In the best case, say, I'm going to Christianize these people, right? And that's got its own imperial history and the like, but at least there's a motivation there. So oftentimes, yeah, you would justify, you'd say, well, yeah, they work for me, they're my slaves, but they didn't have the mindset that we have necessarily now, and religious education would be important to them.
Yeah, I wish I knew more of the story because the 19th century, up until the Civil War, slavery is just, it's bonkers is making too light of it, I think. You think of like Frederick Douglass mm-hmm. and there's a whole bunch of biographies of these escaped slaves that are mostly fraudulent. Then you get like Frederick Douglass's biography and just how awful it was. I mean, we know it was awful and, yeah. you know, duh. But I mean, it was illegal to even teach slaves how to read.
Yep.
That became, so, yeah. I mean, this is the later decades. This yeah. is the later decades and when, like in American history, we go boom and bust,
yeah.
right? We go big and then we go silly. I mean,
that's
they're
Christian
kind of the
story. Is amazing to me. I mean,
the slaves are Christian.
Yeah, that they would still retain the religion of
I know.
Their masters.
I know.
I mean,
me
I would
too.
Be mad as.
I mean, yep. if you look you know, at
me
American,
too. I'm amazed by that.
Yeah.
American demographics show us that the African American community is one of the more
Christian
devout.
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
And there's something, and don't underestimate, I think, the connection between the Old Testament, the Exodus,
yes,
the slaves, yeah, and their experience.
Yep.
Because when you go, it's Go Down Moses. It's all these songs that really play on that. And there's a connection there that those who've not been enslaved, we just read about it.
You know? Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, I mean, that's such a tradition. And obviously you're going to see even longer than the white church or the non-African-American church, they're going to stay involved in their society in a way that we all kind of ditch after the First World War. It ceases to be chic or even okay in some ways to be a supernaturalist Christian. As sort of the birth of modernism post-World War I, the African-American community, they don't have that same tradition necessarily. And so some of the best kind of maybe social work that we see, right, is going to come out of that movement if you look at Martin Luther King, et cetera.
Right. So the next step here, the last several episodes, you said the idea of the secular, like we have it in our minds, wasn't really existent. That church and religion were just so much more a fundamental part of life. But now during this time period, we're seeing secularism or the secular emerge.
Yeah. Secular is a good word. To trace it, let's use the word atheist first.
Okay.
Michael Servetus, right? Gets burned, right? For being
non-Trinitarian,
or what they would say, as it was written down, an atheist. Why? Because atheist didn't mean no God. That's stupid. Atheist meant a different God, right? Uh-huh. There's no concept of this, right? Believe it or not, there's no blind watchmaker before the watch, right? And so you can't do that.
Well, his other one's an eyeball.
Yeah, well, there you go. That's, oh, be he. But I, you know, so, I think that's, you know. Sorry, I lost myself.
Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah, that's fine. Now
when we make jokes.
Oh, the atheist, the secular versus the sacred is a distinction that we begin to see in the Reformation, but that distinction is always made with these things understood to be right next to each other, right? The sacred and the secular, and so you could in the left-hand kingdom with the doctrine of vocation, you could enjoy the secular. Secular and atheist come together in the second half of the 19th century.
Hmm.
Secular and atheist, what's today? Humanist, right? When I hear humanist, I think of those 16th century guys doing great things.
Right.
Other people think secular humanist.
That's brutal when you're writing papers, by the way, to correct yourself.
That's the bastardization of these ideas. And so the secular, atheist, humanist, I've mentioned this trio, and it's just for memory's sake, I've always put them together, but Marx, Darwin, and Wagner, they're all producing in 1848. So just helpful for me I just put those things together. But what were they all doing? They were all replacing religion with something else, right? With Darwin, it was a kind of watchmaker God, a blind God. And with Marx, it was reductionism and, you know, money as the only thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then with Wagner, it was the hyper-nationalism, which just look at the history of Germany from then on, and you'll see, you know, what that does also in the rest of the world. It's a replacement for religion. And I think this is where we see this in America. We see it across Europe, but in America, something replacing religion. And that's this new secular, but it's just secular whatever you add to it. It could be hypersexuality. It could be sports. Whatever you're going to put in that bin.
It's interesting to me that you know, the three names that you use, it's all in different areas. So like with Darwin, it's sort of freeing creation and science, and especially in the legacy of those ideas. Marx, like you said, economy, people sort of day-to-day life, and then the political world. All three changing within the same time.
And Wagner, the arts.
Yeah.
That he's changing the arts in a way that is divorcing it. Now, Wagner is his own ball of wax, but the idea of not Christianity and, but Christianity or.
Mm-hmm.
That's a 19th century thing. One of the reasons comes out of liberty, which we've been touching a lot upon, right? And with the growth of all these new denominations, if there are 10 churches on my block, that's going to make it a lot easier for me to not go to any of them. Mm-hmm. Because they can all think I'm just going to the other one. If there's one church, they know where I am.
Yeah.
And so there's a way in which, oh, how many churches? How? Forget it. What else can we do? And we see, you know, Christianity doesn't help this with its groups like the YMCA, you know, is going to sort of move into this new world of secular and sacred. And of course, they kind of try and balance the line, but by their second decade, they get rid of Bible study altogether and say, let's just do sports.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It's funny to me that they haven't changed their name.
Yeah, it's like KFC. Like, we only know it is the thing, and I've got to tell my kids what it stands for.
Yeah.
But it's not very.
It's weird. Okay. Sorry.
And the YWCA.
Yeah.
Should have the Y.
See,
yeah, I don't know. Yeah,
why?
Or just, how about the gym? That's where I have a good old secular.
Who was it? Uta Linnemann in Germany, Bultmann's top grad student of his whole life, and she went to a drinking a fifth of scotch a day. She went to a YWCA meeting and was roundly and soundly converted to Christ.
Interesting.
And I go, holy smokes! I thought both those organizations were defunct. But somewhere, somebody preached Christ to her.
Here, the legacy of the Reformation, and this is where I'm going to go a little bit rosy. The legacy of the Reformation, for all the wackiness of there's not just one man in charge and one, you know, mother church, but as many churches as you can have. The Protestant idea of at least the beginnings of a sola scriptura, or this idea that it's the Bible. Now, that gets perverted in a lot of different ways. But American religion is based on a book. Americans were a people based on a book. They were educated people. And the fact that the Bible makes its way through all these groups, sometimes supplemented with other works, does give us these things like Billy Graham and these people who kind of pop up out of nowhere who, it's because, you know, the Word of God, you know, fulfills what it promises.
You guys have that issue that was issued from Christianity Today on Billy Graham after his death?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I think their whole thing's online too, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a distinction between members and non-members. I don't know what that is.
I'll see what I can find. So Dan, the other part that I think will be interesting for me and maybe for listeners here is the rise or the origins of fundamentalism.
Yeah, we're headed there because we've got all of these distinctions and all of them are as legitimate as any other when we want to look at or tell the stories of these various groups. But when it comes to, in the Enlightenment, we said supernatural, anti-supernatural. Mm-hmm. We're going to come to a head in American culture and history with a similar question. But instead of just doing supernatural, anti-supernatural, you're going to get a group of people coming together who are going to create something called the fundamentals. And the fundamentals are kind of two things. One, they were a series of books put together by some rich Texas oilmen who came out and formed the Bible Institute of Los Angeles, or BIOLA. And you can check out the original fundamentals in their library. I've gone and seen them before, up in Whittier. And this was a defense against theological modernism, which was the anti-supernatural side.
Yep.
But what these men did, and then the later fundamentalists so-called did, is they laid down five doctrines. Hmm. And they said, these are the five doctrines. And if you hold to these, you're safe. We're going to get into those a little bit later, I think, on the next show.
Okay.
But that becomes the story of you know, the next century of Christianity. Is modernism versus fundamentalism. It's helpful to remember fundamental meant the things that are core to what we believe.
Yep.
What some people might call their confession or their orthodoxy. It's come to mean something else in modern parlance, but we shouldn't let that mess us up when we're looking at especially the late 19th century folk. Like I said, they're a mixed bag. They're missionaries. They're hanging on against some German assaults on you know, the Bible and on reason and the like. So they're fighting a fight that I'm glad I don't have to fight.
Yeah.
And they made some moves there that I probably wouldn't, but then again, I wasn't there fighting that fight.
Yeah. On our liberty and tolerance balance here, are Christians, because of, it seems like there's just, like you said, the just, you know, eight churches on every street, there's such diversity. Are we now towards, in regions and areas, more have more liberality in choice of religion, or is it still sort of, we'll tolerate you, but this area is still Protestant, or this area is still Catholic, or Wesleyan?
You know,
the
tradition of liberty continues as we keep moving westward. It was fashionable, maybe in the first part of the century especially, to divide from your old denomination. We see this happen, but this is what you did, right? You became the new Baptists or the this Baptists or the this Methodists. As we get into the 19th century, you throw away the old phrases, the old word, you know, Baptist, Methodist, and you become, I mean, in a sense, this is the birth of non-denominationalism, right? It's this freedom that says, oh, I don't have to kiss the ring of someone at the presbytery or the synod office or the what have you. And it's kind of, it goes extreme. And we've got to figure out how that works. A really interesting case in 1879 that goes all the way to the Supreme Court about some Mormons who are bigamists in Utah.
Yep.
And how can we allow that? Or not allow that. And it's really one of the things that develops how we looked at religious liberty in the rest of our time here. And they said, you can't be a bigamist. Because if what you're doing is harmful to the state,
yeah. mm-hmm.
you can't do it. And yeah. that's going to set a precedent that is curious. I mean, there's lots of discussion there. But nonetheless, what the nature of the Christian state... you know, how much distinction should there be? That's going to be a big question.
So I think with the remaining, I don't know, 8 or so minutes that we have here, within the dates that we are here, the big political event is the Civil War. How does the Civil War tie into the progress or lack of progress or a regress in religion, or what effects does it have on theology outside there were some theological battles?
Well, I think it's fascinating because it shows us a kind of American usages of the Bible when we go to a lot of these theological reviews. If you go to Harvard, Yale, some of the schools we mentioned before, they have theological reviews. Go to their 1850s or 1840s, and you're going to see conversations about slavery. Right, it was all over the theological world, just as it was in the 16th century in a way with De las Casas. And what do you do with another people? And are they human? And if so, are they someone for whom Christ died? And that's going to become the tricky thing. And in a way, for the Christian, that's the only answer. And so if the answer is no, well, then have at it. Do what you will. Mm-hmm. If the answer is yes, we're going to have to rethink everything. So... you know, everything is put on hold in a way during the Civil War in the early years of Reconstruction. So we don't see a lot of movement in terms of, you know, literature. There's not a lot of, we've got Civil War poems, but we don't have a lot of active things coming out of this.
I mean, in theory, almost
in sciences,
almost every man of working age is going to be involved in this.
Yeah.
Which is sort of interesting, but.
The real movement here, and historians tend to go, is they tend to go towards African-American spirituality because we see a lot of it, obviously, right? And the records we're seeing and the emancipated slaves and how they're believing and worshiping, it's, like I said, they're keeping the slave master's religion. How strange.
It really
is. But they're
going
to turn.
And deeply.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Deeply.
In a way that we, a communal sense, right?
You think as less is written and recorded sort of academically, like you said, things are sort of put on pause here, that it's interesting that you then also see an uptick in the recordings of people's voices who weren't considered people before, right? You said
that's getting recorded. Yeah, historians, we're looking for any kind of source. So if somebody wrote something on the back of a napkin, we're going to try and grab it, especially if it was 100 years ago. And there are certain times where we have a whole bunch of academic tomes. And so it serves us best to go and say, what were they saying directly? But at the same time, if people were saying things elsewhere, I'm going to learn just as much about American Christianity going over to the Saddleback campus, right? Or I'm going to learn a lot about it going over to the Saddleback campus here in Orange County and being amongst that than I am, say, just reading Rick Warren's book, right? I can get something from both, but the aspect of sort of living amongst it is important.
So I should save my napkins and that I
do on. Well, only
your napkins probably aren't gonna.
Said if they're 100 years old, if someone wrote it down, then we're.
That's kind of funny. Anything else we need to know as we transition into next episode, sort of modernity and fundamentalism, like we touched on a little bit? Is there any other core piece here?
Yeah, you know, I think it's helpful. Sometimes we have these names kind of floating around, and if you're thinking of sort of who's when and where, you know, I think. With the Second Great Awakening, if you look to Timothy Dwight and Barton Stone, I think they tell very interesting stories. Timothy Dwight's the head of Yale. We mentioned him on a past show. And he's going to sort of set the tone of Northeastern Christianity. Barton Stone, out of Kentucky, is going to set the tone for the early kind of Second Great Awakening Christianity. And it's got kind of its rural tone. And so you can find sermons by these guys. The tradition in the Northeast is also going to go from Timothy Dwight and Yale into people like Lyman Beecher and that kind of what would become anti-slavery kind of Northeast. So the real story, I think, is it's all one big story. And we do ourselves a disservice if we try and break it apart too much. Because especially, as we said, in the time we've looked up till now, your religious life, your political life, your social life, it's all together. It's here with the birth of kind of a secularism and then into modernism next century where things will start to look, one, weirder, and two, more like the present.
Great. Well, I didn't do an intro on this episode, so I'll do a little bit more of an outro this time. There are still a small handful of registrations left for the Here We Still Stand conference in San Diego, California. It's at the Hyatt Regency Mission Bay and Spa.
You got it. In
San Diego, California, really close to SeaWorld. It's a great location, and it's, more importantly, a great conference. We have 3 days packed with speakers, and in addition to speakers and breakouts and things like that, lots of downtime, which is my favorite part of it, because you can actually talk to people. You can talk to people who presented at a breakout. You can talk with other Christians around you. It's really the best conference I've been to of any type. And so registrations are $199 with you can get $25 off with our code PNET19. You do that at the registration at checkout. I'll put that in the show notes. We'd really like to see you there. The first day is a podcasting day. It's a lot of fun. You just register. You come get your bag, your shirt, and things like that. We have a small lunch for people who register. And then we do live podcasts all day from various shows on the podcast network. I think this year we're going to be able to squeeze in 5 shows. It's a little tight. You get 1 hour, and then it's the next show. And you get 1 hour, and then it's the next show. So if you are there, you'd be able to join the Thinking Fellows for a live recording. We do the last recording of the day there. And we usually open it up to some questions at the end, and we have a really good time. So yeah, please consider joining us there. And as always, remember to check out the rest of our resources at 1517.org. Lots of podcasts at the /podcasts and all other sorts of resources. And if you feel so encouraged, please do consider hitting the donate button in the upper right-hand corner of the website there. Anything helps. And like I've said on past shows, if you're able to commit to sort of a regular reoccurring amount, that's really great, because it's some consistency for us where we know there's people out there who are looking to consistently and regularly fund this project that we are all a part of. Thanks again. We'll talk to you next time. Bye.